That's called Not Alone, music from Carolyn Ahrens, and we heard two from the new Gaither Vocal Band, Have You Made Your Reservation? 8.5 minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and a member of the board at Creation Moments, and he joins us just about every Tuesday morning. We talk about science, and we talk about faith, and we talk about creation, and we talk about young Earth and old Earth, and we talk about dinosaurs. Don, it seems like we've been talking about dinosaurs a lot lately, doesn't it?
Well, it has, but there's been a lot in the news, so I guess there's more stuff to talk about.
You suppose this comes out because of that Jurassic Park movie that's about to premiere?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, actually, it premiered.
Oh, it did?
About a month or two ago, it actually came out.
Oh, well, it shows you where I live. It's not showing here in East Dakota.
Well, it probably showed, and then you missed it, and now it's not showing anymore.
Well, I think I've seen it before, even though it's a different movie here. I don't know what else they can do with dinosaurs than what they've done.
Oh, yeah, they make them, they're making them bigger and, more terrible. So
I did see a movie from a Lord of the Rings from the Hobbit series, and they had just an excellent dragon. I mean, the dragon was just fearsome looking, and close ups, and it looks so real. The computer graphics are getting just outstanding now, and so they can make a dinosaur do just about anything they wanted to do now, including speak English. In this case, the dragon breathed fire and then spoke English, which was intriguing altogether. But this article in Popular Science tells me that scientists are warring over the ultimate dinosaur question. Were dinosaurs quick, warm-blooded animals that would be endothermic, or were they ponderous, cold-blooded animals, exothermic? Or could they be both? What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on the dinosaur that you're talking about, because a dinosaur is a class. Of course, dinosaur means a terrible lizard. Mm-hmm. You could have both. Not in the same animal, obviously, but some dinosaurs were probably warm-blooded and some were cold-blooded.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but they were all they were they all then reptiles? I mean, is that
well,
is that,
that
a requisite
was the question? If they were reptiles, they'd be cold blooded.
Okay.
And so apparently, some are cold blooded and some are warm blooded. So anyway, this article tries to determine whether or not the dinosaur was cold-blooded or warm-blooded based on fossilized eggshells.
Well, they can't just run out and take the temperature of a dinosaur. There's got to be some other way. And I wonder if this makes sense. I was looking at this, and the scientists look at the chemistry of eggshells, and they've done it with modern critters, and they think they can do it. So they say, well, hey, why not try a dinosaur egg and see where that leads us? Does it work?
They got an answer. Here's the technique. What they're looking at is the heavier elements, heavier isotopes of carbon and oxygen. So they're looking at carbon 13 and oxygen 18. And the question is, if the research has found with eggshells, of modern eggshells, that is, that if it's a cold-blooded animal like a reptile, then the radioactive isotopes tend to cluster together or clump together. If it's a warm-blooded animal, they are more diffuse throughout the eggshell.
Okay.
So that's the technique that they used, and they looked at a number of warm-blooded bird eggs, for example, and then they took 9 reptilian eggs, and I'm sure there was a spread of clustering versus the temperature of the
So this would indicate the temperature inside the animal at the time the eggshell was formed, right? That's what they're trying to detect here.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
And so once the eggshell is formed, then, of course, it's frozen in time, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the hypothesis, and it's probably a good one. And then, you know, the egg is laid and there you go. So they did this with these number of eggshells and found that there was a good correlation between temperature, body temperature, and the clustering of these heavier isotopes of carbon and oxygen.
Okay.
And so they said, voila, we have a technique for measuring the temperature of, you know, of dinosaurs, or at least the female, at the time the egg was formed. So they looked at a sauropod and a triceratops, I think it was a triceratops egg. Anyway, they found that the sauropod egg had a temperature roughly around 100 degrees, where the it actually was a theropod, had a temperature around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So there was a difference in temperature. So they're saying, well, you know, one was probably a warm-blooded creature, and the other one was probably a cold-blooded creature.
Well, but there's another step to this, and they also had to determine the outside the ambient air temperature. And so if the dinosaur was warmer than the ambient air temperature, that would indicate that it was hot-blooded. And is it the other way around? How does that work?
Oh, yeah. No, well, if the egg measured warmer than the ambient, in supposed ambient temperature, then, yes, the animal was a warm-blooded animal because they could generate heat in inside. And if the temperature turned out to be the ambient temperature, then it was probably a cold-blooded animal because the cold-blooded animals, just to get their heat from the surroundings. Mm-hmm. That's why you see lizards and snakes and other, you know, creatures like that. Just kind of, it looks like they're sunbathing. Well, they're just absorbing heat so they can move. So anyway, they did that, and interestingly, they said, well, it looked like the ambient temperature was somewhere around 79 degrees. Now, that seems to be a fairly accurate number.
How do they figure that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially since they consider that these things lived
65 million years ago.
So it's kind of when they publish some of this data, sometimes they don't put the error bars with it. So is it 79 plus or minus 1 degree, or is it 79 plus or minus 10 degrees?
Yeah. The estimated temperature in Mongolia's Gobi Desert 65 million years ago was 79 degrees, and that was the question that occurred to me. How do they know that?
Yeah, exactly. So that's it's an interesting question, but interesting the number that they reported, but I'm sure it's the average number, and it's probably got a broad range. And the other problem, of course, is that's the average temperature. What was it during the day and what was it during the night? Because
when that egg formed, what was the temperature? I guess they have to determine.
Right. Yeah. So there's, they actually determined this based on the rocks. Here we go back to the rocks.
Yeah.
And what the, you know, whether the dust, for example, if some of it, was fused, then it was a warmer temperature than if it wasn't. And so all of that, you know, kind of went into play. So anyway, if they've got 79 degrees as the ambient temperature, and their theropod seemed to be 90 degrees, it would suggest that perhaps even the theropod was a warm-blooded animal. But you know, it could have gone up
a little vague,
to 100 degrees during the day, and
a larger animal naturally be warmer anyway than a smaller one? I don't know. It seems like there's an awful lot of variables not taken into consideration here.
Well, it's needless to say, and the article kind of concludes with this. It's a it's a puzzlement. And while they may have shed some light on some of the answers, there is still a lot of, as you suggested, a lot of unanswered questions. And whether or not, you know, dinosaurs are cold-blooded or warm-blooded. And I suspect that God created both.
Well, so. I think that could well be. And why this is such an issue? Well, I suppose they want to know, and there are people making their living trying to determine this. So they got to come out with a report now and then.
Yeah, and why is it an issue? Because it's if you know, believe in evolution, then the hypothesis is that while these were all reptilian-like creatures, and so you you know, what would evolve from a reptile? Now they suggest that some of the birds evolved from the reptile, but birds are warm-blooded. So if you know, all dinosaurs were reptiles, then that would pose a problem. So if you can find some warm-blooded dinosaurs to evolve into other warm-blooded creatures,
this would support the theory then. Yeah,
that would you know, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing, so we don't have to worry about that as a creationist, right?
No.
Because God created the animals as he created them. And he created the beast of the field, which most of the dinosaurs would fall into, on the day six. Mm-hmm. And at least the land-bearing dinosaurs were created on day six, and the water-bearing dinosaurs were created on day five. And so, for example, a plesiosaur would have been created. It would be a sea creature, so it was created on day five, whereas a behemoth or a sauropod or you know, the land dinosaurs, for example, mm-hmm. would have been created on day six.
Where does Leviathan fall here? Is that a sea creature?
That's a sea creature. So where do we you know, in Job chapters 40 and 41, for example, God is confronting Job and saying, basically trying to put him in his place, because Job was obviously very prosperous, and God allowed him to prosper until Satan came to God and said, you know, let me test him, and he'll certainly, you know, reject you. And God said, okay, well, go ahead, but you can do basically anything you want to him, just don't kill him. And so, of course, you know, he got boils, and he lost his family, and this, that, the other. We know the story. But at the end of Job, it talks about these two magnificent creatures, and God. One is the behemoth, which is spoken of in Job, starts at Job 40, verse 15. And it's got a tail like a cedar tree, and some have suggested that it was a hippopotamus, and a hippopotamus does not have a tail like a cedar tree.
No, they don't.
And so it was probably a brachiosaurus or some type of animal like that. So if God is telling Job about a animal, certainly Job would have knew exactly what God was talking about, and that creature was around when Job was around.
You know, and interestingly, you bring up Job. As I understand it, that book makes more references to snow and ice than any other book of the Bible. And there's some thought that it may have the story itself may have taken place during an ice age, which would suggest warm-blooded.
Yes, it would have. Mm-hmm. Of course, the sea creature, the Leviathan, which is mentioned in chapter 40, 41, is a fire-breathing, you know, dragon that lives in the sea, and God references it. So obviously Job knew what that creature was like. The whole point being that, you know, these creatures didn't live before man. They lived with man. And, of course, after the flood, there was a lot less food for them, and so they probably slowly died off most of them. There may be still some dinosaurs. There are references, or people suggest that there have been sightings of some of these creatures in the Congo, for example, mm-hmm. or remote places of the world where man hasn't killed them. But even in man's history or man's legends, of course, we've got the knights, you know, fighting fire-breathing, dragons. And, of course, over in China, you have all kinds of things, celebrations with the dragons. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
We have legendary tales of dragons, and we have recorded history of dragons as recorded in the Book of Job. Mm-hmm. Man lived with dinosaurs for a period of time. And he was quite familiar with dinosaurs, and so the concept that the dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago and many, many millions of years before man came on the scene is not quite accurate historically.
Well, and they're still fighting. Warm-blooded, cold-blooded, or something in between, or both. So it sounds like this has yet to be resolved, and we'll keep an eye on this for you and report any any exciting findings on the part of the paleontologists there. Don, I've got a let's work with these questions. Now, over at Creation Moments, they have asked their website participants, the members and subscribers to Creation Moments, to suggest questions for Dr. Don that have to do with creationism and young earth and old earth and the like, and a number of questions have been submitted. We would like to kind of introduce a new feature with Dr. Don, and we could call it Ask Dr. Don, or maybe it doesn't even need a name, but you've got a couple questions for us that you would like to deal with. Tell us about those.
Well, yes, they were submitted to, I guess, they're friends of Creation Moments.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, yes, one of them is, for example, why is there a limit on the evolutionary age of the universe? And, of course, the question goes on, you know, a little bit longer than that, but that's the basic question. And so, how is the age of the universe actually determined? And... why is there such a limit? Because the age of the universe actually has changed over time. One would think that it would, yes, of course, it's getting older.
I was going to say.
But, it started off being a billion years, and then it got, that wasn't long enough for evolution to take place. So then, went to 10 billion, then to 15, and now it's 18.3 or 18.4, billion years old. So, why is it continually changing, and what is the age based on? And the age is actually based on a cosmological age, for the universe, with the assumption that things that we see way out in space are older than things that are nearer in space. And if you believe in the Big Bang, that is, that everything started from a singularity or a point source somewhere in our universe, then things exploded. And so those things that were came out from the first front part of the explosion, for example, which would be farther out in space now, would be the oldest. So that's the hypothesis, and how do they measure it? Well, they look at galaxy clusters, for example, and the age of the universe was kind of set when through the Hubble telescope, because before we could see as clearly as we could with the Hubble telescope, we had huge telescopes here on Earth, but the atmosphere obscured the data, and you couldn't really see as far out. So the Hubble telescope was put out in space beyond our atmosphere, and once the telescope was realigned out in space, it began to bring back nice clear images. So they looked for the farthest galaxy cluster. I mean, this is so far out that you can't even see a galaxy. Mm-hmm. You have to see a cluster of galaxies to have enough light to even see it. And so they found some, and then based on luminosity, if you will, the apparent luminosity of those galaxies, they could give a rough estimate as to how far away that galaxy cluster was, and from that determine the age of the Earth, with the assumption, again, that the speed of light is constant. And, you know, of course, you know, in physics and in cosmology, they absolutely, you know, declare that the speed of light is constant, and that that's the only thing that doesn't change. But as we've talked about, there are mechanisms for light to hit the Earth quicker than just the normal speed of light. So anyway, put that aside for the moment. They determine, okay, that this is 18.3 billion light years away, and so therefore the age of the universe is 18.3 billion years. So now, if they get a bigger telescope, or if they can see even farther out, then that age is going to change, based on the same type of analysis and assumptions.
Hmm.
So that's where the evolutionists get the age of the universe.
So there's new information from better technology that causes them to keep revising the age of the universe. And
that's exactly right. Yeah. And before that time, it was almost a guess, but they were still using astronomical bodies as kind of the age of the universe. And so determining that this whole our whole universe that we live in today is approximately 18.3 billion years.
This is probably way over my head, but it seems to me if you're going to age the galaxies farthest out, that's only meaningful if you're at the point of origin.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever that happened to be, and we have no idea where that was. Do we?
Well, that's an interesting question in itself. I mean, if you look at, for example, galaxy, or it appears that galaxies are kind of clustered in rings, and so there does seem to be a center, and our galaxy appears to be in the center of the concentric rings that go out from our galaxy. So it would seem that the old adage that the Earth was the center of the universe, well, maybe it's not necessarily the Earth, or maybe it is, but it appears that our galaxy is probably at the center of the universe.
Yeah, but see, that's skewed too, because we only see what we can see, and the universe from some other point may look entirely different.
Well,
I mean, it's like you look at constellations and we see shapes, but from some other perspective in space, you wouldn't have that shape at all. That's only because we're here on this point.
Right, and we can only see, you know, pretty much in two dimension, and infer maybe three dimension from the objects that we see, you know, from space.
Yeah.
So, but we do know that it appears that how do we know the shape of our own galaxy, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's by analyzing the Milky Way, which is all the stars kind of, you know, in our galaxy, and the density of that, and we can figure out that, gee, it looks like our galaxy is probably a spiral galaxy. It looks like a typical spiral galaxy, like the Andromeda Galaxy, which is almost flat on facing us. And we can see the spiral arms in the Andromeda Galaxy, but obviously it's a little bit more difficult to figure that out with our own galaxy.
And that's interesting. You say we would see in two dimensions, but that's right. I mean, we're only seeing height and width, and we're presuming, if we can see depth with telescopes, that something is part of that galaxy that may in fact be more distant or not part of it at all.
Well, and
the third dimension is subject to question here.
Well, yes, and kind of no. And I'll give you an analogy.
Okay.
So in microbiology, for example, you use a microscope, obviously. But if you've ever looked at a cell under the microscope, you see a two-dimensional image.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got certain types of microscopes, you can focus on that cell at different areas. So if you have a highly defined focal point, you can focus like on the top of the cell, and then you can kind of take layers within the cell of the cell based on the focus, how you're mm-hmm. focusing your microscope at
That's
the time.
That's kind of how an MRI works, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But the MRI moves, and so that's why you move in and move out. Mm-hmm. But if you could focus at different layers within a cell, then you could recreate, and we have recreated the three-dimensional image of the cell. So if the same premise holds for telescopes, for example.
Is that if with a capital I?
Well, I'm not 100% sure on that on that issue, mm-hmm. but one would think that you could use similar types of principles to get a pretty good estimate mm-hmm. Of the three-dimensional structure of a astronomical body, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it wouldn't be as good as if flying around it, as we've sent out, probes into space, for example, and just barely getting out of our own solar system. but at the same time, you could get a gross estimate, of the three-dimensional structure okay. of astronomical bodies, which were pretty far out.
Well, then, so the basic question it has been answered, and the reason it changes is because of changing technology, new information, new data that results in new analyses.
Well, that's correct. So if, for example, we would come up with a telescope or some type of instrument that could measure even further out into mm-hmm. space, then we might suggest that, the universe is even older.
But it also follows that with each piece of new evidence, the universe can only get older, not younger, unless it's something
exactly.
other than the speed of light, something other than a visual piece of evidence.
Mm-hmm. You're right. So, okay. Well, the universe is getting older, but I would purport that it's not as old as they think mm-hmm. it is.
Yeah. Okay, got another question there?
Well, another one is, do creationists believe there is life elsewhere in the universe? So that's I'm not asking about spiritual beings like angels. I'm asking about physical life like we have on Earth. Is there anything in the Bible that addresses this issue? And the answer to the last part of that is no, there mm-hmm. isn't, because the Bible is focused here on Earth. And of course, we do get glimpses of angels, and we know about Satan and some of his cronies. But as far as corporeal beings like ourselves, the Bible gives absolutely no indication that there are beings out there in the universe. And here's my belief is that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because think of what Christ did on the cross. So he paid the price, for our sins. And, of course, the wages of sin is death. And so he had to die on the cross in order to pay the price for our sins here on Earth. Now, if there was another planet on a different, in a different galaxy, in a different, solar system, if you will, then at some point in time, those people would sin and then would require a savior as well, because the character of God is going to be consistent. And so is Jesus going to have to die yet another time for those folks again? And the story would have to repeat over and over again. I think not. I think God created the universe as we see it. It didn't take 18.3 billion years, but he did it, within the 6 days of creation. And he created man here on earth, placed man within the garden, that is the Garden of Eden, or East of Eden, and as it's described in chapter 2, then the whole, creation story then is wrapped up with man here on earth. And, of course, the salvation message then is Christ dying on the cross for us, coming out of the seed of Abraham, and is the second Adam, which obviously, saved us from our sins. Mm-hmm. So there is obviously absolutely no proof of life anywhere in the universe, even though we continue to look for intelligent signs, and there is a lot of money being spent, has been spent on scientific instruments probing the universe for a consistent signal, if you will, not something, not background noise, which is what you get mostly out of space, but some type of signal that would suggest that there's life or evidence of life outside of universe. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, our planet is sending out all kinds of information. For example, from the Earth in the forms of radio waves. And we beam messages up to satellites, and they beam them back to Earth, and those beams, pass the satellites, so that information is getting out into space. And if there was anybody, listening, they might, if they had sensitive enough probes, might be able to detect our jabbering and even this program.
Well, I should say, if you're listening out there, welcome to Broken Road Radio. We're peaceful people here, so don't
tell them about the Indiegogo campaign.
So anyway, there would be, we've got a noisy planet, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And any intelligent life looking in would say, wow, these people got problems.
Yeah, let's press another button there, would you? And let's see what else we can get.
So that's the type of information that we're looking for, or we're looking for example, a sequence of numbers, or a sequence of data that would be an irrational number, or the prime numbers, for example. If you had a sequence of prime numbers as dots or beeps or something, you might say, wow, there is a sequence here, and mm-hmm. we recognize the sequence as this, then therefore there must be intelligent life. Well, none of that has been ever
found. Of course,
found,
that's all based on the presumption that everywhere in the universe the same laws of physics would apply, the same laws we know and recognize and have defined for ourselves here. And I guess there's no way to know that. I guess it's a good assumption.
Well, it is a good assumption when you look at the number of creatures we have here on Earth. I mean, in the variation, there is obviously similarities in the creatures, and hence, because there's similarities, that's mm-hmm. where evolutionists get their stories from, that this evolved from that because there's similarities, phenotypic similarities, that is, they look similar, but also DNA similarities. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, as creationists, we say, gee, isn't it, we got a wonderful creator who designs similar things. And mm-hmm. if we look at ourselves, we do the same thing. We design a car, and we put four wheels on it, typically. I mean, you have some cars with three, but you put four wheels on it. It's got an engine. It's got a mm-hmm. transmission. So there's parts in common. mm-hmm. The myriad of cars that we have. In the same way that our Creator God designed things here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, interesting. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, biochemist and member of the board of directors at Creation Moments. I want to mention their website because you can find, if you're interested in young earth creationism specifically, although they cover a lot of other topics, the resources at Creation Moments would be a bonanza for you. You can find it at creationmoments.com. You can link to it from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Perhaps you're listening there rather than live 365 this morning. If you're on our website, just look to the right-hand side. You'll see it's a picture from space with the Creation Moments logo. Click on that. It'll take you to their website. And you'll find articles and DVDs and radio programs. Of course, we play Ian Taylor and Creation Moments here on Broken Road Radio a couple times a day. It's good information, and I would encourage you to go there with an open mind and examine the science. Be critical of the science, but examine it critically and not emotionally, and see what you learn at creationmoments.com. And Don, as always, we're grateful that you were here. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
I didn't give David a chance at a question. Do you have any questions, David? Did we?
Who, me?
Yeah. You were so quiet. Just so quiet there today.
I didn't see any reason to break in. No, it's okay. Interesting stuff.
Okay. All right.
Very interesting.
All right. Don, have a good week, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, sounds good. You folks do too.
Bye-bye.
See you, Don.
So long.